Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast with me, Gemma. I am your host, and this is the parenting podcast with a difference, because it is all about talking about our gorgeous children with all kinds of additional needs and disabilities. So how has your week been? Have you got your tree up? Because that is exactly what we've been doing this weekend. Trees up, decorations up, house is absolutely destroyed. Because obviously once you have kids, it's not as simple as like, oh, we'll take a few hours to do it all, because then they're needy and they want things and they need a nap and they need feeding and you have to keep them alive. So currently we have decorations up, but all of the boxes that said decorations came out of are literally, I'm looking, I can't cope. Like everything for me needs to be away and in its place, and I'm currently sat in something that looks a little bit like Santa's mail room, maybe. There's empty boxes everywhere. There's all the boxes of my Christmas shopping that I did in Black Friday. So that is all over the floor. I've got a huge pile of stuff I need to get on Vinted, and I need to stop because it's stressing me out. I'm just going to turn my back to it and pretend it isn't there. It's that time of the year, isn't it, where everything's gorgeous and magical and lovely, hopefully, but also quite stressful as well. Anyway, on to this week's episode. Now, this is actually a chat that I had, God, it weeks and weeks and weeks ago. But actually, it's been quite nice sitting editing it, revisiting that chat, because I really enjoyed this episode and I hope that you'll feel the same as well. So I'm joined by SJ Phillips to talk about her children, Ollie and Amelia. Now, between them, they have various different diagnoses, which I'll let her get into, but we will be talking about autism and how that presents differently in both of her children. We'll also be talking about ADHD and global development delay as well. Now, in this chat, SJ talked quite in depth about the fact that she had to take her local authority to court in terms of school places, but she really gives some super helpful advice. Like, she talks through the process and what that looked like and what certain things meant and how she got the help to actually be able to go to court. So if you've been through that, I think you'll find this incredibly relatable. Or if you think you might need to go through that, she has got some excellent advice. We also talk really in depth about how the pressures of having children with additional needs broke down SJ's relationship. And I was really grateful to her for being so honest about that, because as I actually mentioned in this episode, I would love to know what the statistics are for how many relationships break down after getting a diagnosis, because just of the additional pressure that it puts on, I'd imagine those figures are quite high. So we discuss that. And we also talk about how SJ's putting things in place for the future, for Ollie and for other children and for other parents raising SEN children as well. It's so admirable what she's doing. But anyway, if I carry on, there'll be nothing left in the episode, will there? So let's get into it. SJ, thank you so much for joining me.
Right, thank you for having me on.
Now, this is actually our second attempt at doing this. The first one failed because I was in Alder Hey with Leo. Completely forgot to cancel. And I was like, oh my God, I'm supposed to be doing a podcast recording. And I'm sat in a room watching him have oxygen because he had a chest infection. So sorry about that.
Oh, no, honestly, this is life, isn't it? As a parent of a child with additional needs, this is just life. It happens all the time. It's so hard to make plans.
I know. Well, it's so hard to make plans and actually keep them. So you are here to chat about your children, Ollie and Amelia. Will you just tell me a little bit about them before we start?
So Amelia, she's 10. She is, oh, she's bonkers. She's gorgeous. She's funny. She's really out there, loud. She's a mini me. Loves animals. Really, really smart. Too smart for her own good. Really sociable, not shy at all, very out there. And then we've got Ollie. Ollie, oh, he's just so gorgeous. He's so loving and sweet, and he loves being outside. He's a real outdoorsy kid. He'll be in the sea, whether it's winter or summer, with his clothes on or without, if you can get there fast enough to get him changed. Yeah, he's a little bundle of joy, loves being outdoors and in nature. Very feral, my children, both of them, actually.
I think in general, children are feral, especially, I mean, my Leo's 3, toddlers are the most feral of them all, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
Now, have Ollie and Amelia got the same diagnosis?
Not quite, no.
Okay.
So they're very similar. My children are a brilliant example of it being a spectrum with autism. So Amelia has ADHD, and she does have autism as well, but she's very her autism is very different. She's very profoundly ADHD. She lit up that scale and ticked every single box. The autism with her is a little more subtle, whereas Oliver is, he's got profound autism. He's nonverbal. He's also got a global developmental delay. And that's caused quite a, again, a profound level of disability. He's like in a special school, he's nonverbal, like I mentioned. So I've got two very different ends. Amelia is extremely bright, very high functioning. She was reading before she was three fluently. So I've got very opposite ends, very different children.
And before Amelia was born and you got her diagnosis, did you know much about autism?
No, I'll be honest. I'm actually a healthcare professional. And since having the children, I've become very clued up, obviously. But even before realizing Amelia was neurodiverse, and before having Oliver, I became a disability assessor. And even with my training for that, nothing prepared me. And I didn't really understand it until it became my life.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of people listening could relate to that. I've spoken to people before who kind of work in that sector and have said that it's just completely different looking at it with mom eyes. And I've heard people before say they've kind of forgot everything that they know from work when it's actually their child. Did you kind of feel that?
Absolutely. Living it and learning about it and applying it in practice and actually experiencing it, I cannot tell you how different it is. Yeah, it's two worlds apart. You genuinely do not understand it until it becomes your life.
So I'm guessing, given that you said that it presents in different ways, I'm guessing that with each of your children, the reasons that you suspected that they might be neurodiverse were very different as well?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How did that look with each of them?
So with Amelia, she was always just bonkers, bouncing off the walls, full of energy. She was like Duracell batteries. She just kept going and going and going. She just didn't stop. We suspected that she had ADHD from a really young age, but we were advised by the school, really poor advice, to see if she grew out of it, or to see like if, because obviously we know girls mask really, really well. And basically, they advised us to just see how she went. She was in a very small school, really small class sizes. So she dealt with it really well. Well, she did until she didn't. As she got older, it got a lot harder for her. And I feel like I really let Amelia down because we held off getting her diagnosed. Whereas with her brother, totally different. So I ended up having to deliver and resuscitate all of them myself. He wasn't right. I knew he wasn't right from day one. He was 12 days old before he even probably cried. He had jaundice. I just kept being told it was the jaundice, but his SBR levels came down to normal and he was still very dopey. Like, I knew from day one there was something wrong, and it was serious. And I was just completely ignored, fobbed off, told I had a good baby. And then with Ollie, the signs were just there. Like, 8 weeks came. There was no smiling. He was just no expression. It came from really early on. I knew with Oliver that we were looking at something pretty serious.
Sorry, can I just go back? You delivered him yourself?
Yes.
How?
Yeah.
How did that kind of come about?
So I've got pretty high pain threshold. I live with chronic illness myself. And I just assumed I had back pain. I labored right in my back. I only had miscarriage to compare it to because my daughter was a cesarean.
Right. Okay.
So I called my friend who was a midwife and I went through everything. She's like, no, it's not labor. And I was like, oh, okay. And then when I realized it was, by that point, I mean, I was pulling him out of my pajama bottoms within 15 minutes of that. We are just down the road from the hospital. So literally, I got in the car. I could feel I was sat on him at this point. And we literally pulled up outside. I was like, you can't park, you can't park. And I pulled him out of my pajama bottoms like Lion King. Didn't even know the gender at this point. Just saw that the chest wasn't moving. And I went into medical mode and I just started resuscitation. And it was so strange. Like, autopilot took over. I was just like, right, don't cause a pneumothorax, which is where you can end up collapsing the lung. I was so gentle with the breath. I didn't even associate it with my baby. I just was like, boom, 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 boom. And yeah, that took over. And then next thing I know, the crash team are there. They're cutting the cord. They're running. They just went to me, we've got to. And I went, go. They went off. And I was just stood there. And then, yeah, I think it was about 30 minutes until I actually got Oliver on me, stable. And yeah, it was
incredibly traumatic.
Yeah, I think it actually impacted his dad a lot more than me. We can't talk about Oliver's birth and we can't go past the spot. I've been in that hospital a lot since my own health, and the entrance through maternity is always quicker to get to my ward. But his dad, like, we can't go in that way now because he just freezes at the spot. And he'll cry if we talk about it. We can't talk about it. It's really traumatic for him. I think it just absolutely terrified him having to witness that. And he just couldn't do anything. And yeah. I think obviously it impacted me too, but at the time you get on with it, don't you? And in me, it showed in different ways. Like, I wouldn't put him down. I always had him in the sling. I always had him on me. So I think it presented like that. The trauma with me.
That's a lot. Yeah. I'm sorry that happened to you. So when you became aware that something was different with Ollie, how long did that take for you to get a proper diagnosis? Was your experience with him different? Did people listen to you or?
Yeah. So I was lucky. At the time, I was actually working as a disability assessor. So I was listened to. When we really pushed, Oliver was born in 2019. So we went into COVID when he was about 6 months. So all the health visits were done over like Teams or phone call. And what it was the ages and stages. He was four times over the referral threshold. And I realized this coming up to it. So I phoned the health visitor and I said, look, this is the situation. And she was amazing. We got him referred to the CDC immediately. And the GP asked me to write a supporting letter as a mum, but also as a healthcare professional, and putting in what I did as a job and that, and like what all the things were, that the signs and the things I was concerned about. And straight away we were referred and put on the list, but it took a long time. It was an 18-month waiting list just to be assessed.
And how did you feel getting a second diagnosis?
I'll be really honest, for me, it was extremely tough because of what I did for a job. So I get the worst of the worst cases on my desk. If I'm getting cases, it's people who are always going to need care. They're always going to need help. They're never going to live independently. I knew too much. So I'll be honest, it was absolutely horrific. It was like a 2-week mourning period where we mourned the life we thought our child was going to have. It felt like someone had died. Honestly, it was devastating. We couldn't eat. We couldn't sleep. We cried all the time. It was hideous because I knew too much. Like, I knew what was to come. And I thought the worst from day one. I really did. In a way, for me, it was harder because I knew that I lost my hope. Whereas everyone else has hope and they hope for the best. I was looking at it from a very realistic point of view, worst case scenario. So for me, it was really, really tough.
Yeah, I can see how that's like a double-edged sword. Obviously, you have a lot of information that you can use to help him and I guess things that you could put into practice, but I can totally see how I think I would feel the same. Obviously, Leo's only three, but there's definitely certain things that I would actively stay away from wanting to know in terms of what the future could look like.
I totally agree. I think a lot of the time ignorance is bliss with some of these things. It's just that hope. Like, the one thing that always pulls us through is hope. And when you feel like you've lost that, it's really tough.
How long do you think it took you to kind of come out of the other side of that? Because I think anyone listening to this podcast has gone through that kind of grief and that, you know, that huge range of emotions that you get when you get given a diagnosis, you know, whatever it is. I think a lot of the time, the name of the diagnosis is different. It presents in different ways. But I think a lot of the feelings as a parent that you have are, you know, exactly the same. Yeah. How long do you think it took you to kind of get to more towards a place of acceptance? Like, are you there?
Yeah, I am now. I would say it took a good 6 months. And what I did was I had to just change the way I was thinking. Like, you cannot control what is thrown at you, but you can control your response to it. And I realized that, and that's where your power is. How you respond to a situation will have a massive impact on the outcome. So you have more control than you initially think. And when I adopted that way of thinking, it changed everything. And I was like, right, so what are we going to do now? And I got into this mode of, we need to do everything we can to support this child. We need to make sure, you know, he's got everything he needs. And I started fight mode. And I think that kept my focus. I got educated. I found out our rights. I found out his rights. And I started the fight. And I knew I was prepared by professionals, and everybody had told me that it was going to be a challenging road ahead. We were going to have to fight for everything, EHCPs, all of it. And I prepared myself. Like, from day one, I told myself, this will get rejected, we'll have to appeal. That will get rejected, we'll have to appeal. And I was always ready for the fight and always prepared, knowing that I'd have to have it. And I think that massively helped. So I did grieve. I had my time to do that. I felt how I needed to feel. And then I thought, right, move on. What are we going to do about it? And I just got into that mindset, and that's kept me going ever since. And honestly, Ollie has amazed us. He's done so much more than we thought. He's come on leaps and bounds, and it's actually a lot brighter than I thought it would be. And the progress and development he has made is giving me that hope back, the hope I had lost because I thought I knew too much in all of this. He's every month, the progress he's made, he's showing me more and more that actually it may not be as bad as I'm thinking.
You've mentioned the word fight there, which I have heard other people talk about multiple times. And we're talking about the school system, I'm guessing here, are we?
Yeah.
Okay. Talk me through how that's...
Everything.
Okay.
Everything. Just even to get just to get listened to by healthcare professionals, just like, it's a fight from that. It's a fight from everyone, your friend, everything. It affects every area of your life. It's a fight across the board in every way, but especially the education system, yeah.
And how has that looked for you?
So Oliver clearly had a very severe level of disability. And yeah, I still had to take the local authority to court to get him into special school. I also had very serious health problems myself, and I actually took the local authority to court from my hospital bed. And like, the judge was like, why are we here? And I was like, good question, Your Honor. Local authority, why are we here? Like, the case was done in minutes. There was 500 pages of medical evidence submitted to the court, and the judge was like, why are we here? Like, this is pointless. It was so clear that Oliver needed specialist provision.
But can I ask? Because this is obviously something, you know, this is across the board, isn't it? And I haven't spoken to anybody, I don't think, who without paying somebody to help has had a smooth process with the EHCP and the school system. So what in your case was their reasoning? Because you've said he's obviously has, you know, a high level of need there. You have a diagnosis. Yeah. What was their reason? I mean, I'm guessing it ultimately all comes down to funding, but what did they say was their reason for?
So there's four reasons why they can reject an application for a special school and they have to pick one. But I'll tell you what the actual reason always is. They're full. There are no places. So they're not allowed to turn around and say there's no places. And in Oliver's case, that was the reason. There were no places. So because they're not allowed to do that, they have to pick one of the four. So they just picked one. I can't even remember which one it was now, but it was hilarious because we were like, well, that's ridiculous. It was very easy for us because we were able to go to the legislation and we would be able to be like, boom, boom, boom. There you go. You're going against the law here, here and here. And that's why it was a slam dunk win, because they didn't have a leg to stand on. But that's what they'll do. They'll reject everybody because there's no places, and they'll hope that you're going to back down and accept it. And this is why you've got to fight. Look at the rates where we get through. It's like 90 something percent because all these children need the place, but they're rejecting everyone in hope that the parents won't fight it. But as this is one of my key points, know your rights, learn the system, know the legislation, get very familiar with the Keeping Children Safe in Education guidance and also the Children and Families Act. get very familiar with that and know your rights, learn the system, because it's the law and they can't say no. So they will try, and they'll try and get you to back down, but they can't. And none of the four reasons, like Oliver didn't apply to any of those. Like there was no way they could reject him, which is why the judge was like, and like laughed it out. But they will try and they will give a reason. You've just got to fight it.
So this might be a silly question, but I've only gone through the school process for my older children who are neurotypical. So I haven't had to do an EHCP application or any of this as yet. We're about to start with Leo. If the school, the special school, is full, how does that then work? Do they just make an extra place, essentially?
Essentially, yeah, they have to. So what they'll have to do is they'll have to find one of the schools where they can get another member of staff in. But essentially, yes, we did hold Ollie back a year. Had he been late, like slightly overdue, he would have made the new school year. So when I was booked in, you know, they book you in for an induction just in case. Had he come then, he would have been the next school year. So because he was so close to that, we held him back a year anyway. He was very much a baby. He wasn't ready for school. He was still needing that like nannying that you get in nursery. He was still needing that level of mothering and that like baby care. So we actually held him back, and that helped our case because it meant that a place could be sorted. It gave them time. So that's an option as well. They do recommend that a child stays within their age group. And we know from the evidence and research that it is more beneficial for a child to stay within their year group. However, like I said, with Oliver, it was very different because developmentally, he was significantly younger than his age. And he was right on that cutoff anyway, because he was an August baby. So we felt it was in his best interest to hold him back. But at the end of the day, the local authority have a legal responsibility to provide an education, and they have to do that. And when you've got an EHCP, that is a legal document. It is your only protection for your child. It's like your only safeguard as a SEN parent. So that's why that document is so essential, because they legally have to meet the provisions laid out in that. And if they can't do that in a mainstream school by getting staff in, and they can't do that, then your child needs to be in a specialist provision. But they've got to find education for your child. That is their, that's their job. That's their responsibility. So this is why I say, learn the system, know your rights, learn those pieces of legislation like the back of your hand, and fight for it, because your child is legally entitled to that provision.
So you said then that you had to take your local authority to court. Did that cost you money, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I got Pias involved. I didn't pay a penny for any of this. I got Pias involved. So in Plymouth, we have Pias. This is what, like, education is like, learn the system, learn what's available. We had Pias. I think other areas will probably have something different. But they were the charity organization in place in this city to support SEN parents who are having to appeal things or go through this. As soon as we started the EHCP process, I was put onto Pias and I got in touch with them. This is before we had to appeal anything or anything. We went into this being told everyone has to appeal. So I got everything in place then. So I was working with Pias from day one. We had lots of team around me meetings, and there was always someone there from, I was invited to Pias as well. And I had everybody involved from really early on, but it was all free services and help that I accessed. And that's, again, my advice, like, find out what's available. Don't just say, oh, listen to people saying, oh, there's nothing. Because often there are charitable organizations that will help and support you. There's other SEN parents online who've been through it and will willingly give you their advice. Anyone in your local area who's been through that local system, reach out to them, ask them for who they use for support. But no, I didn't have to pay for anything. It was all done through like charities and organizations. And a lot of it I just did myself. I compiled the evidence myself, got familiar with the legislation, knew my rights, knew my boys' rights, and stuck it to them.
I think this is super useful information, I think, that you're giving here, because there will be a lot of people listening who will have had to do exactly what you've done. So I think it will be a very relatable thing that you're saying to a lot of people. But I think people further behind you on this journey who are starting to apply for schools or starting to apply for EHCPs or even just thinking about the future and what education for their child's going to look like aren't going to know this. I don't know this. So this is... Yeah. This is something like, thank you for sharing all of that, because I think there are going to be people who find that really, really useful. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
An amazing resource that people coming up now through the system have that I didn't have is AI. So ChatGPT, make it your best friend, guys. Use it. Ask it, because it's a great starting place. Although it has its faults, it will get you off on the right foot and you can start your investigation. So use AI to help you find relevant legislation to you, relevant help and services and free organizations in your area. Like, use it, ask it, and it will give you the starting points, and that will then lead you on to find what you need. So use the resources you have at your fingertips that are free and accessible.
I'd like to talk to you, if you don't mind, about not necessarily admin, but I suppose it does fall under the category of admin. So in terms of keeping on top of appointments, and I guess all that you've been saying about school applications and appeals and all of that, do you find that as a mum that falls to you, or do you find that you and your partner kind of split that fairly evenly?
Don't be ridiculous. Of course it fell on me. Of course it did. So I've just made a video about this on social media and it went absolutely massive. It's got over 500,000 views. And it was talking about this, how even when people are married, it always falls on one person. And it does. Like, the majority of time, there's a tiny, I would say probably 2% of the people in my comment section had their partner help them. And everyone else, whether married or single, they faced it alone. And I will be honest, this was a huge thing for me. I felt so abandoned, so alone. And it was a massive thing that put pressure on our relationship, because I felt so let down. And there's many reasons why, you know, why our relationship didn't work. And we say to each other now, we've got very good co-parenting relationship, and we laugh and we say, gosh, how would we have coped if we'd have stayed together? Because we desperately need our time off. And now it's fab because we can tag team and we each get a break. But it was a massive contributing factor to our separation, because I was just dumped in this. And then I got really poorly. And when I say really poorly, I actually have an incurable prognosis. I've already outlived my prognosis. So when I was laying in a hospital bed and we genuinely didn't think I was coming out, the kid's dad went to me, oh, you've got to teach me all this stuff. Like, who do I do for this? How do I do all the Ollie stuff? And I was just like laughing in his face. I was like, mate, this is years worth of stuff. There's so much. There's so many people involved. And like, luckily I've got folders full of everything. But I was just like, you can't just learn this in an afternoon conversation. This is years worth of fighting. So many people involved. And it's all the future stuff. It's setting up assisted living in the future. It's making sure we got the right services involved. It's estate planning. It's everything. It's making sure he's protected, making sure there's power of attorneys in place, making sure he's not going to be taken advantage of down the line when we're no longer here. Like, there is so much. He just didn't have a clue, and he still doesn't. I was very much abandoned in this, as I think I would say probably 85%, maybe even higher, of parents are. It's usually always one.
Were there any kind of benefits, do you think, to it being all on you, in terms of you were across everything, or was that just a solely negative thing? Because that's a lot to take on. I think it's a lot to take on, the admin and the mental load of parenting in general. But parenting a SEND child and everything that brings it's a lot. It's too much, really, to do alone, isn't it?
For me, it wasn't a benefit at all. It was awful. I felt like he knows this, and we talk openly about it. I felt like he really let me down. He really let me down. And especially when I got sick, I was dealing with incurable illness myself. I was suddenly, my children are probably going to still be children when I'm no longer here. And I had all the weight of the world on my shoulders. I had to provide for them for when I'm not here. I had to do all of this. And get provisions in place for Oliver for the rest of his life and protect him. Plus, we were dealing with Amelia. We got her privately diagnosed. It was just everything. Again, all of that was on me. I paid for that as well myself. Like, all of it was on me, everything. And I just felt like I was fighting everything alone at a time when I needed support because I was facing an incurable diagnosis myself. My entire life had just gone upside down. I felt like the weight of the world was on my shoulders. I was drowning and I had no one. I literally felt abandoned by everyone who should have been there to support me. And I'll be honest, it left a really bitter taste in my mouth. I've got a lot of resentment over that. I felt really let down.
Yeah, I think the fact that you earlier on said that you were taking your local authority to court from a hospital bed when you have...
I shouldn't have done that.
No, not when you have a partner.
Exactly. And this is the thing, that day as well, he didn't even come to the court thing. Like, just to be there, like, even if you've not been involved, it's a good show to just be united. And the fact that he couldn't even see that, like, I did feel really bitter and resentful. I did. And I just think it's a really tough thing. And if anyone's listening and, you know, at the minute you're just leaving it up to your partner, just bear this in mind, you know, they're going to need support. And even if your role is just emotional support, fine. Like, if they'd rather get on with it, fine. But be there for them. I didn't even have that. You know, just that backup and just knowing they're there and being able to talk to them and all of that. Like, even that is support and that's help. But I didn't have any of that.
I think the sad reality, though, is that the majority of people who listen to this podcast are women. So the parenting and this, and I understand that lots of people listening will have supportive partners who are helping them, but still, the majority of that will fall to the woman as the mother, as the primary caregiver in most situations. But yeah, you're right. I think that support doesn't have to look like necessarily filling the forms in. I mean, if it did, that would be great. But it can be there in other ways, can't it, in terms of emotional support?
Yeah.
I'd be very interested to know, actually, if there are any statistics anywhere of how many relationships have broken up after receiving a diagnosis for your child, because I'd imagine that it's quite high.
Going through the comment section on this video I posted about this, I would say it's really high. There were so many comments from women who left their partners over this.
It was something interesting that you said, though, because my youngest, Leo, that he is mine and my husband's baby. I say baby, he's three, he's still my baby. He's mine and my husband's baby. But my older two children, I co-parent with my ex. And it was a very interesting point that you made, because obviously, when you have children with somebody, you never go into that thinking that that relationship won't work. And you never go into it thinking, ah, well, if we split up, you always go into it with high hopes, thinking this is forever, we're going to have a baby and it's going to be magical. And then the realities of parenting, send parenting or not, hit and it's different. But I think that there are actually big positives if you are co-parenting, especially if that is more a 50-50 split.
Yeah.
Because like you referenced, you get a break.
Yeah, 100%. And here, I know there's so many single parents who do not have the support of the other parent and they are parenting a thin child, and that is hideous, especially if they don't have family support. It is just, I can't even express how hard that is. It's awful. And when I go into hospital, I go into hospital for like a month at a time, and the child's dad, like after a month, he's on his knees. I'm having to get my family to fly over from overseas to come and help because it is too much. And it is not something that you can do alone properly. You can't. Like, it's too hard. You can't be deprived of sleep like that. Like, our boy does not sleep. And it's not okay to expect that from one parent. And we don't have family support. The children's father, like, his parents are elderly and they live miles away. And he has some family fairly locally, but they have never offered us help. They've never given us any support. And my family are overseas. They try as much as they possibly can. They come over as much as they can, especially when I'm in hospital. But they've got lives overseas and running businesses overseas. They can't just come. So we have to be a team, whether we like it or not. And that is not easy. But my goodness, thank goodness we can do it, because it is easier for us. And we do say all the time, like, we really feel sorry for our friends who are married with 10 kids, because they never get a break. And even when you're like, oh, well, one person will do it, that you're still in the house. You're still there. You're still soaking up the stress levels. You know what I mean? It's not a break. Whereas I'll go up the spa and have an actual break and not have to be around the home environment. And I actually do get a break. And we tag team it. We're really lucky. We never had to go to court. We never had any nastiness. We were able to do a schedule that suits us. So if one of us has a bad night, for example, last night, Ollie's dad had an awful night the night before. So I had him last night. And then if one of us has a bad night, the next night the other parent has him, because then you're guaranteed that it's all right, tomorrow night I'll get to sleep. And we do that. We really share it out, because it's the only way. And it's about the children at the end of the day. And we do strongly believe that in order for our children to be okay, both mummy and daddy need to be okay. So we do go to great lengths to support each other. But it's all about keeping those, like, the children at the centre. So I've done everything I can do to accommodate the kid's dad being in full-time work. And he's remained in full-time work in the same job he was in since before he even met me, all this time. And he's now supporting me with me growing my business. And with when I model and I go off to London and I have to go away. And we're able to do that because the way we work. So it's having that mutual respect. And it's not easy. We have our moments, believe me. But we just keep the children and everyone's well-being at the focus of it. And we manage.
I think that's such a great example of how co-parenting can work. And also, it's an example of a situation that you would never choose actually potentially turning out to put you in a better position and make life a little easier than it was before, which you would never think going into a separation, this will make my life easier. But sometimes it just turns out like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really has, definitely for us. And like I say, we get that break. And what's so lovely about the fact that we never had to go to court or anything, we're not restricted. So if he wants to go away or his folks are down and he wants to go for a meal with them, of course I'll have them, that's fine. And then it works both ways. I try really hard to do as much in the school holidays as I can. And I'll go over and stay with my parents. So I took them for a lot of the summer to back home to my parents. So he was able to carry on with work and things. But then he's really accommodating when I need him to be. And when you tag team it like that, it's just so much easier.
Yeah. And I think you're right about keeping the children at the centre of it, because it does sound like, well, you use the word resentment, and I can completely understand that. And I think anyone listening would absolutely feel the same. And I think well done for kind of, you know, putting that aside and doing what's right for the children. I think that's really admirable, because some people aren't able to let go of things like that. And then it just it puts a negative spin on everything, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I wasn't a saint in it. Like, there was resentment. And towards the end of our relationship, the environment got really toxic. And that's why we decided to separate. We actually sat down and we were like, we looked at Amelia, and I just said to her dad, I said, how would you feel if she had a marriage like ours or a relationship like ours? And he went, I'd be devastated. I said, me too. I said, but we're showing her this is normal, mate. I was like, we are showing our daughter that this is what a normal mummy and daddy are like. And she is going to set her standards for her future relationship off what we are teaching her. And I said, so how about we separate, we each find our person, and we show her what a healthy, loving, respectful partnership looks like. And that's the goal. You know, we want her to set her standards a lot higher than what the example we gave her, because we just weren't right for each other. And when you put two people who aren't right together in a stressful situation, raising a child with additional needs or children with additional needs, it is going to go to pot.
I completely, completely agree. And it was exactly my mindset splitting up with my ex-partner of, this is what you're showing your children. Like, they are learning from you and they are soaking it all up. So I couldn't agree more. And, you know, just what you said at the end there, adding on, you know, additional needs into that, I would imagine that a diagnosis of any kind that puts an extra level of difficulty onto parenting, which is already hard, I think that probably with most people's relationship either weakens it or massively strengthens it. I think it's probably something that either pushes you apart or brings you much, much closer together. And a lot of that really is down to luck, to be honest, how that Absolutely. Goes for you.
Yeah, definitely.
You've mentioned your business that you're trying to grow. I'd love you to talk to me about that, please.
So I'm growing something at the moment. Basically, there's a massive need for adaptive housing across the board. So I've created a company which is making adaptive homes for people with physical disabilities, but also adults with learning disabilities. So we're doing lots of physically adapted homes. And then we're doing shared houses for adults with learning disabilities, where you'd have like a living carer going in, or assisted living facilities where there's always someone on site, but they might be able to live in their own flat without someone being in there all the time, but just someone available on site. So I'm creating these homes. I'm doing it in a very different way than it's ever been done before. I'm also going to be having a domiciliary care business on the other side of that. And all sorts going on. But the reason I'm doing this is I've been paralyzed 3 times myself, and I wasn't able to access my own home. They tried to put me in a nursing home at 30. And the only reason that I avoided that was because my folks had a flat in the city that I could use, which was all on one level. I had to wait well over a year for a stairlift, which was supposed to take 2 weeks. Even with the stairlift, my mobility scooter can't fit down my hallway. So when I'm needing those aids, I can't live at home. I was away from my children for almost a year, like not properly able to be at home with them. They were having to come to the flat, but I was needing help to have them. It was just horrendous. So I want to improve things for anyone else going through that. Also, as I mentioned, I am unwell. My condition is incurable, and there is a very high chance that I will not see my children at childhood, and I need things in place for my son. So I want to create a number of lovely, lovely forever homes for basically any other child like Ollie. We're also creating, it's several businesses under a big umbrella company. There's lots of companies. And another one is financial advice and estate planning. So we've found ways to protect people's assets, ensure that basically other SEND parents don't need to worry about what happens when they're no longer here, because we'll get them the appropriate advice, we'll protect things, we'll get everything in place so that their children are safe, they've got a forever home and everything's taken care of. Don't know if I should say this on here, but we've also found legal ways to offer advice, which means that when a parent needs care and they own their home, rather than having to sell it to fund their care, we can find a way to make that asset non-means tested so that they get to keep their home and it can go on and fund their children's needs. And the state will fund their care. So these are all services we're going to be providing through my company. We're also going to be providing jobs for SEND parents. So this is how that's going to look. It's going to be flexible, as in actually flexible. There's a lot of jobs within companies that can be done at any time of day or night. So if you've got a few hours between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m., you know, you can do it whenever. We're going to be able to offer a range of contracts, a range of hours, so people can work as much or as little as they like. I want to be able to offer fully paid mental health days, 5 a year to all members of staff, where if they're just not feeling it, they don't have to go in. I want to be able to offer fully paid childcare days, at least 5. And if your child has an EHCP, that will double to 10, because they're significantly more likely to be off school. Again, fully paid days. I want to offer private healthcare, dental care, mental health packages and support, proper employment. And the way this will work, it's multiple companies under one company, and it's non-profit making. It is purpose driven. So everyone's paid well, and any other profits go in, but a lot of the profits are spent paying people well. And we're able to offer these adaptive, brilliant homes to social housing providers at a rate they can actually afford that isn't going to cripple the economy, because we're not being greedy and lining our own pockets. We're trying to provide a service that is so desperately needed that isn't currently being offered in a sustainable way. So yeah, that's the goal. I am working on it. It's happening. It's genuinely happening. I've got all the wheels in motion. I've got everybody getting it going. But yeah, watch this space. Things are going to change.
I think that's really lovely because, as you know, as a SEND parent, when you look at the future, you do think, well, if I try not to look at the future too much, but when you do think, oh God, like say in my case, I'm like, is it, you know, how's that going to look? You know, when he's older, when he's an adult, where's he going to live? How much support's he going to need? What happens when we're not there? You've obviously had those thoughts as well. Mm-hmm. And I think what's lovely is you're really putting stuff in place now, which is exactly what Ollie's going to need later. But also you're doing that for other people. And I think it's amazing that instead of kind of just sitting there panicking, you've gone, okay, let's do something about this. And also, I think it was very interesting what you said about giving employment to SEND parents, because this is an issue that I've not spoken to anyone on this podcast yet about, because that is something that is incredibly difficult for a lot of, and again, mainly women, to stay in work when they have a child with high needs or a child who, you know, even if they are in full-time childcare. I've spoken to women before who are getting calls 2, 3, 4 times a week. You need to come and pick them up because they've hurt themselves or they're unwell. And that makes it incredibly
difficult.
Or they're
on the roof of the special school.
Yeah, I haven't had that before.
Old school.
Oh, God. When you are getting constant phone calls like that, it's very, very difficult, unless you have an extremely understanding employer, to remain in work, isn't it?
Absolutely. And also at Oliver's school, so there is no wraparound care. So there's no before school club, there is no after school club. We are instantly indirectly discriminated against because in mainstream, those services are available at pretty much every single school. They are not at all special schools. So again, this is something that I want to provide. And it is a job that SEND parents can do themselves. Like, we can actually staff wraparound care using the parents to do it, which is, like, as long as they're paid really well. And, you know, again, it's something where the company that I'm creating will have the funds to supplement that, to be able to do that, because all the profits are going back into it, because it's purpose driven, not profit driven. And this is why, like, we can do that. Some of the domiciliary care as well, the carers are going to be paid so well. People are going to be queuing up because they are going to be so respected, so valued, so well paid, because all the profits and the property business profits are going to supplement that too. So we can afford to pay people what they should be paid. This is the whole point of doing it this way. But I chair the PTA at Ollie's Special School, and I founded a charity to support the school financially because it's so underfunded. And I had a meeting to basically tell the parents what we're trying to do. Does anyone want to join the PTA? And I could not believe it. The hall was rammed, and it was like a Wednesday afternoon. And I was like, why is no one at work? And then I realized, well, they can't, can they? How on earth? How do we even have a, like, what job are we meant to do? You know, how do you do it? You can't. Like you say, employers just, they don't understand. They don't get it. You cannot hold down a job when you have a SEND child, and you've got to be there to put them on a bus, get them off a bus, and there's only a few hours in between. And then half the time, like you say, you are called in, like at least twice a week, I'm called by the school. All this week, I'm having to take Ollie in because we've just been having so many difficulties with the bus in the morning and getting him in. So it's impossible. And this is exactly why we're going to be offering these jobs. I'm also teaming up with someone else who has a business which is perfect for this group of people, to offer them employment which is flexible and to encourage them to make their, create their own businesses. So I'm teaming up with her, and she's going to have that opportunity as well as another employment option for people. And that job as well is willable. So it's something where they'll create their business, and it will go on and on and on. So they'll be able to leave it to the children in the will, and it will fund that. There's a reason I'm working with her, because she's got this opportunity where it is willable, and it will continue to bring in money long after the parents no longer here. So I'm got all this going on to try and support our community of SEND parents, set up their future, protect their assets, give them some assets to protect in the first place, but ensure ongoing care and stability for their children, something I'm creating, and I'm doing it on a national scale. So we are literally doing this across the country. Our homes are going to be available across the country too. We're taking this all across the UK. So everyone will be included in this. The opportunities will be there for everyone across the UK.
And is there somewhere where people can find out more about this, or is it still in a very early planning stage?
It's in an early stage, but it's going to happen quickly. So following on social media, I guess, maybe at another date, I'll let you know when we're all kind of off, but people will hear about this. We're going to make sure it's everywhere.
Amazing. And if people aren't following you, what are you on Instagram?
So on Instagram, I'm Spoons and Spectrums.
Now, SJ, I finish the podcast with the same two questions every time. And the first question is, what is the best piece of advice that you've been given along the way in your journey as a Send mum?
It's survival. It's you versus them, and you do what you need to. So trust your instincts. You're their voice. Learn the system. Knowledge is power. Know their rights. Know your rights. Find your tribe and give yourself grace. Because what you're doing is, like, just no one understands. No one will ever get it until it becomes their life. But overall, it is survival. And yeah, you do what you need to. Don't let other people judge. Don't listen to it. They will never understand until they are in your shoes.
And my final question is, what do you know now that you wish that you'd known when you got either of your children's diagnosis?
I think what would have really helped me is, it's very well known in the Send community, but Welcome to Holland. It's like it's not quite a poem, but it's kind of a poem. But if you look up Welcome to Holland, I found that very comforting. I use it to help describe it to other parents of neurotypical children. I use it to help them to just get an understanding of what it's like for us. But more than anything, I wish I hadn't known. Like I said earlier, I wish I hadn't had the medical knowledge and known what I did know, because I just went straight to worst case scenario and got myself in a real bad place and stopped seeing that hope. But yeah, Welcome to Holland. Had I had that, and also just knowing, you know, there is always hope, and it's clinging on to that. It's finding the sunshine and clinging on to that. And the truth is, we don't know. Just because someone else's child did this or went this way, it doesn't mean yours is going to. And like my son, he amazes me all the time. He's giving me new hope all the time. He's not so-and-so's child. He's not so-and-so's cousin's brother. You know, he's my boy, and he's different, and he's going to do it his way, and your child will be the same. So just go with it. Read Welcome to Holland. And don't forget to miss out on those gorgeous, wonderful things that you get to experience, because you're so caught up on what your child is missing out on or isn't going to get to do. Don't miss all the incredible things that they are going to get to do and all the joy that's going to bring.
Perfect words to finish on, SJ. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
I love that SJ's just reminded me of that Welcome to Holland poem. I know that not everybody loves that. We got sent it really early on in our journey with Leo, and it really resonated with me. I definitely didn't believe it at the time, because he was so tiny and we were so early in that process of acceptance. But I do think that it sums it up beautifully. I'm sure that you all have read it if you're listening to this podcast. Like SJ said, it's very, very well known within the Send community. But if you don't, look it up, and maybe it's a nice chance to revisit it if you haven't read it for a while, like me. So yeah, I love that chat. And once again, I learned so much. I really hope that you found that helpful. If you're kind of at an early stage, like me, with a younger child, and you haven't started this school application process yet, and the HCP and all of that, I thought SJ had some super, super helpful advice and information there, which I certainly didn't know. And if you've already gone through that process, maybe that really resonated with you. Maybe it was very similar to what happened to you. I just hate the fact that it's so hard. It's almost like it's set up to fail, isn't it? And all because of money. But anyway, let's not get into that right now. So another fabulous episode. I hope you'll agree. And that's it for me for another week. As always, I would love it if you would rate and review the podcast, if you would subscribe, follow, all of that, because it helps people find us. If you want to send me a message, you can do that via the Instagram at the Send Mum Club. You can slide into my DMs with guest suggestions. You could suggest yourself. If there's anything that you feel like you would want me to talk about on the podcast, I would love some suggestions of that as well. Or if you just want to drop me a message just to say hi, that would also be nice. Okay, that's it from me. I'll see you back here next week.